Good day, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 24th, 2002. This session is Formation of Ministries, Formation of Assembly, Formation of Ministers. This will be presented by Marty Haugen and crew. You can find this in our library or order it under the heading of LIVLIT, which of course stands for Living Liturgy, 2002-06. Let's listen in on.
The work of your hands. We are all the work of your hands. We are the clay, you are the potter. We are the clay, you are the potter.
One of the things that was so exciting when we were asked, Mary and Dan and I, to come and work with Susan and Tom at the village was that Tom and Susan were already working as a really good collaborative team and modeling that, and they were interested in how this could be done in such a way to help that same kind of collaborative, grounded sense of ministry help other people. This is sort of then, I would argue, could be right at the heart of what the Living Liturgy is about. We're going to look at how we form ministers to form the assembly. It's one thing to sort of know how to do this yourself or learn how to do it or experience or live into it, but if your assembly doesn't live into it, it just becomes one more way of impressing them. It has to be something that everybody does together. So I'm trying to think of a logical progression through this, and what I'm going to do is just talk about a few dimensions of ministry, a few characteristics of it. Then I'm going to talk about a few implications if ministry is this What does that mean in terms of formation? Then I'm going to talk a little bit about the music aspect of it as a musician. And in doing so, I'm hoping to touch on some of these issues that we've talked about. Obviously, some of them are pretty complex and deep, and we're probably not going to solve them, but at least we could say, we hear, and we understand, and we suffer with you. Three simple things that I want to mention. This is not comprehensive. It's very much my own selection. Ministry is the call of every baptized Christian. This is one of the great gifts, I think, of the Lutheran Church to the rest of the greater church, is the understanding of the priesthood of all believers. Lutherans really do believe that, and they really own it. It can be your cross to bear sometimes, because everybody feels they have a right to make their voice known, and they do. It's like one of those consensus meetings at Holden. You know it's worth it, but at the time, maybe it feels like it's not. But ministry is the call of each one of us. Ministry is a practice, not a destination, not something you achieve and you're done. You can go get a lot of formal training in ministry, but the moment you step out the door and the world continues to change, your ministry has to grow and evolve. So like law or like medicine, ministry is a practice. I never understood why professional work like medicine and law are considered a practice. Law, maybe. A lot of lawyers give you the impression that they could use some practice, but doctors, you want them to have it down. You don't want them to be practicing. But ministry, because it is a practice, is more about who we are than what we do. This is what I think the word vocation is about. It's where our gifts and what gives us great delight and what God calls us to come together. And it's a pretty unique experience. I think most of the people on this planet labor to find a place where their delight and their gift and what they can do to serve God come together. So if you found your vocation in ministry, even in the midst of the struggles, you'll do it in situations where you're getting paid very little, getting very little support and a lot of abuse, because that is a great joy to find that vocation. But it's not about simply our skills. And I think a lot of our formation in formal training, whether it's in music or in seminaries or wherever, universities, tends to say, these are the knowledge you have to have. You do these things, now you're a minister. And it's not about as exterior as much as interior. Nobody knows this better than I do. There's times where I think, with all the work I've done and all the experience I've had, some days I feel like I don't function as a very good minister. Nothing to do with what I can do technically, but who I am inside in terms of ministering. And it's a relational vocation. It's not something we do in isolation. A music minister can't be... It's like, if a music minister sings in an empty church, does he or she still make a sound? I would argue no, that it's about a relational experience. It's a vocation that we do together as community. It's more about who we are in community than who we are as individual Christians. And I think in Encinitas, when I gave this talk, I wasn't as clear about this. And someone said, well, we've got this group of teens that are really being formed. And when she described it, it was more about their individual faith formation, which is a kind of formation. But I would argue, if we're making leaders of prayer, it's always being formed into a community experience and into an experience of common prayer. And it's about how the entire community and how the minister helps the entire community abide in the word and abide in the prayer, come to live in it. Formation is so much more than training. Training is a set of skills. Formation is a lifelong task. And I feel sometimes like I have so far to go to be a true minister of word and sacrament from a musical perspective. So what does this mean in terms of the way we get formed? Well, part of the thing is it's the work of the Spirit, which really comforts me some days when I feel like I haven't done my homework or feel like I'm not doing the job I could, that I can give it over to the Spirit, work as hard as I can. A lot of you, I think, are in situations where you have minimal resources, very little to work with, and a congregation that's asking the impossible of you. And some days it's nice to know that the Spirit is there. One of the great functions of a gathering like this is simply sharing each other's stories and hearing that your ministry is not unique in its frustrations or in its joys. Any formation that we do has to be ongoing. You can't do a ministerial program and say for 1 year we'll form our ministers and then it's done. You have to find a way that somehow there can be an ongoing formation. It doesn't have to always be formal conferences, formal training. It can be something done in the context of your groups. In fact, that has to be part of it. Formation has to include the way you pray together and experience life together. One of the things that strikes me so much about the difference between a minister, I'm thinking musician now, although I think it applies to presider as well, and to reader, minister of the word, the lector. In all those cases, the difference between the minister and the performer is the performer operates from a position of power and authority. The presentation that Tom and Mary gave this morning, one of the things that was so good about that, and when Mary and Tom were asking you for qualities that you were seeing, and you said things like, you generated enthusiasm in us, you disappeared. Well, Susan pointed out how they disappeared, and the performer is always the focal point. Always the focal point. The minister is always pointing beyond him or herself to the prayer and saying to the congregation, this is your prayer. Part of that process is vulnerability. The performer, if you sing, if you're Britney Spears, who I saw once on, I think it was, she sang at the Super Bowl, right? Did she? If it wasn't her, then I've never seen her. Okay, somebody sang at the Super Bowl. But in a performance like that, if the audience doesn't sing, the performer still can impress them. If I go to a jazz concert, a classical musical concert, a rock concert, the reason I go is to hear the music, not to have a conversion experience, not to be asked to pick up my cross and follow. One notable exception I had in the last few years, when I went to see the Indigo Girls in concert, I had an experience like I'd never had before. And I wanted to say to musicians, if you want good ministerial formation, go to an Indigo Girls concert. One revelation was I was, for the first time in my life, the oldest person in a huge crowd. It was all mainly women, 28 to 30, about 80% women. Okay, yeah, what about 28 to 30? 18 to 30, yeah. Excuse me. They're all, that's a little narrow demographic right there. And they stood on the chairs through most of the concert, and since I bought my tickets at the last minute and was in the back row, I had to stand too. And a number of times, they stepped back from the mics, and the audience became the congregation and took over, and they stopped singing. I mean, how many times have you gone to a rock or pop concert where the people on stage stop singing and the audience becomes the congregation? And these songs are long, many verses, a lot of words. I get home, and my daughter, Katrina, who was 21 at the time, I said, Katrina, you wouldn't believe this Indigo concert. She said, you went to see them and didn't take me? And I said, no. And I said, the women knew all the songs. I know all their songs. And I thought, for the longest time, I thought, how many of my songs do you know? It was a long, long silence, you know. Well, Dad. But part of it is about the way the performer too often is someone who comes across as the power and the authority. And the minister, when you go like this, you become the most vulnerable person in the room. So a lot of what ministry is about is a profound invitation that can be accepted or rejected. But the only thing you have to do is make the invitation so strong that they can't pretend they didn't see it. You know, you've ever seen this where you... The team has seen this 100 times, but when I first had to sing in a liturgy, it was a Catholic church, and bring the people in, I sat at the piano, and I sang, for a Scandinavian Lutheran, to look at people and invite them to sing is terrifying. And at first I thought the fear in my gut was because I would make a mistake. But as I experienced it more and more, I thought it's about to speak your faith, looking at someone's in the eye, is powerful to sing it. Try, you know, standing 2 feet from someone and singing to them. And there's a beautiful blessing that Tom does in three languages, and I just hate it. And the reason I hate it is because I have to look people in the eye and sing to them. And this is death for a Norwegian Lutheran. But this is the call of ministry, to invite people in to this this experience of back and forthness, to saying, please sing with me. Ministerial formation is about so much about letting go of your control of the situation and inviting people into it. It's so much about mentoring, because mentoring, this is the kind of thing you can't teach. It's the kind of thing you experience with other people and you mentor into it. And this morning when we talked about intergenerational worship, it is so important not to segregate your age groups in your parish by letting, say, okay, this age group can have a liturgy here. I don't know if it's happening yet in the Lutheran Church, but it is happening in the Catholic Church, and it's pretty scary. When I first went to my first parish, the priest told me, 9 o'clock Mass is folk Mass. They only sing music that's less than 15 years old. 10:30 Mass is the organ Mass. They only sing music that's more than 15 years old. 12 o'clock Mass, nobody will sing. They all have a hangover. 7:30 Mass, there's no music. And because I was not Catholic, my first job as a Lutheran, I did what I was told. So at the 9 o'clock Mass, I only did music less than 15 years old. Only the old traditional hymns at 10:30. I was there 9 years. When I came, there was a boy of 9 there. And I brought him into my high school group when he was 14, sang at the 9 o'clock Mass. When I left, he was 18. He went off to college, came back, became the music director of the parish. I was very proud that I had mentored him into being the music director. And I went back and said, Mark, how's the program going? He said, it's great. We've thrown out all that old stuff that nobody knows. And I said, what's that? He said, praise to the Lord, all creatures of our God and King, O Sacred Head. He never sang those songs because he only sang at the 9 o'clock Mass. Do you see the danger of dividing liturgies into styles? You create separate communities. All the people need to hear all the music of God, all the best music, the best new music, and the best old music. This puts a much heavier burden on those of us who are being formed in music ministry, because it isn't enough to just be able to play one style. When we think to ourselves, we'll give this group this style of music because they like that, and we'll give them this style because they like that, it goes back to what Susan said about liturgy as a place where you go to get what you want. One more consumer experience in a whole world of consumer experiences. Liturgy is not about a consumer experience. It's about being called into a life-changing experience in Jesus. It's about being asked. It's the image I use of John 3:16 and Mark 8:34. Welcome, welcome. We love you. God loves you. God loves you so much that he's got a cross just made up for you. And that's what we do. We say, welcome into this life-changing experience of the cross. And part of that means not always getting to sing what you want. And being aware that God's people sing in many voices, many age groups, many cultures, many languages. So the best of the old and the best of the new, done as well as possible. There are many groups. If you go to an African-American community, you'll see an intergenerational choir. There's a great group that I know, Roberts Revival, has grandmothers and granddaughters in this choir. I know a Hispanic group that's got at least 2 generations and maybe 3. I know a Hawaiian choir that has 3 or 4 generations. What happens in the Anglo Church when you have the adult choir, the youth choir, the children's choir, is faith formation, which also happens across generational lines, doesn't happen. You have to be creative with this, saying, how do we create intergenerational experience of prayer? We put intergenerational leadership. When Tom and Mary asked this morning, how many of you have someone like a cantor or song leader who leads the congregation? There were just about a small fraction of the people here. If you've never done this and you want to introduce it, the way to start is get some good kids, 6th, 7th, 8th grade, teach them how to do it. Let them teach the congregation. Train them well. But they will not be caught up in the whole performance, look at me business. They will understand better if you get the right ones. Choose them carefully, teach them how to do it. And I mean, Maggie's 16 now. See, I would bet when Maggie was in 6th grade, she probably could have read the word probably better than most adults, wouldn't you think? Oh, okay. What do you think, Dan? Probably. I think you don't just take anyone. I mean, think at my congregation, unfortunately, anybody can get up and read the word. So we take it serious enough to say we train them. But young people can do this well. You just need to be taught and given the responsibility of leadership. So bring everybody along in the process. I'm going to talk about forming the assembly real briefly. The ministers are formed to form the assembly. Most of the people, and so one of the issues brought up was, what do you do when you've got long-time Lutherans at this church and people have never been there before? It's a tough question. But I would suggest that what we're talking about, the kind of music that Tom and Mary have done, and the old traditional hymns done well, good liturgy, if the symbols are explained through the action well, it's more an experience than it is an understanding. It's not so much, I think, we think that we have to explain everything. When Mary and Tom want you to sing, they can do it without a word. A good presider can show the power of something just by a gesture or by emotion. If the ministers are formed well, the assembly will understand the sacredness of this, the joy and the delight in it. It's more about how we embody the meaning in what we do. That doesn't mean we don't explain things. I mentioned before I do rehearsals almost all the time. And I do rehearsals and I try and explain it. I'll say, well, let me do a rehearsal. This is a rehearsal. Okay. Good morning.
Good morning.
One of my congregation. I'm going to teach you a psalm that we're going to sing today. It's the setting of Psalm 23. I should have had my book with me, but I didn't. So,
first rule of the rehearsal, prepare well.
I probably don't need it. Please open your books to page to number 20, and then tell me what that is.
I'm going to do
something with that. Yeah, open up the page 20 to number 29. Here's what I would say. I'm sorry. Oh, see, this is way. Okay, let's start over again. Good morning. We have a tradition at our parish of singing the psalm in the way the psalm was sang from ancient times, in the times before Christians had books, which is good half of the time there's been a Christian church. And even before that, in the synagogues, the psalms would be sung responsively back and forth. The cantor was the one who knew the text and would proclaim the text, and the people would sing their amen in a refrain. We're going to sing one of those today. It's Psalm 23. I'm sure you all know the text, but the music will be new for some of you. We've sung it here for several weeks, but I want to sing it for those who are newcomers. So please open to page 29. I'm sorry, number 29 in the Gather Hymnal. Excuse me. If you've all found it, just look up. I don't think you'll need it, but it's there if you want it. It goes like this. Shepherd me, O God, beyond my wants, beyond my fears, from death into life. Shepherd me, O God, beyond my wants, beyond my fears, from death into life. Good. We'll sing that after the first reading is our response. You'll hear the cantor sing it once, then just join in. We'll do the verses. Let's take a moment to quiet our hearts and minds before we pray. So I was able to say something about why we do the psalm that way. You can do formation, the didactic stuff, before the liturgy starts in small ways. And by doing it week after week after week, obviously you think through what you're going to say, and you think through what has to be said, or you get up and have a liturgical breakdown number 4 like I just had. But if you think it through, it can be way. Another way, at Mayflower Church, where I belong, we have 2 services. I did a series last spring of like 6 weeks where I talked about the liturgy in between services. I got about 15 people out of 150, but it was the ones most interested. And we talked about how liturgy was formed. Bulletins, inserts, newsletters, a lot of ways to do this. But I think it's important to always be trying to find ways. In the group, maybe I'll have the team offer some other suggestions, or maybe you can later. But the formation of the assembly is so important. And I believe that we do it as much by how we do it well and draw them in. I would maintain if you had Tom and Mary as your music directors, within 8 months your congregation would have a formation understanding of liturgy that would be incredibly deeper without them having to actually do didactic teaching at all. So if you're well formed and grounded in the right, you can bring them along in a very powerful way. Newcomers, see, if I had been a newcomer, I could have followed most of that, right? We avoid jargon, we avoid things that sort of confuse the issue. In this, someone raised the question this morning about people who are wounded. Mayflower's got a lot of people who are ex-Catholics and ex-Lutherans who came there because they had a bad experience, and they say, that liturgical thing I don't want. And I have introduced a Kyrie that we use now at our church. And I did it not by talking about the Lutherans or the Catholics, but by talking about the very early Christians and saying, this is a tradition that all Christian denominations own because it's the big T. You jump over the head of the denomination. If you're doing big T, it should go all the way back. And as Susan pointed out this morning, people carry this baggage a generation ago. People would have said, that's too Catholic. You can move people along. It's this patient, sensitive, understanding, inviting. One of the reasons I don't like to do Sunday worship or lead Sunday worship when I go out on the road is that I don't know the stories. I don't know the wounded people in the congregation. But if you stay at a place long enough and do your job as a minister, you will know those wounds and you will know how to work on healing them and when you do the music and teach it. How am I doing? Am I okay? Sing something. Okay. I'm going to teach you a song by a friend of mine. No, I wrote it. I'm sorry. I was at a conference where a friend of mine, pastor named Ray East, did a sermon, and he was talking about our responsibility as Christians to speak, and he kept coming back, who will speak if you don't, who will speak if you don't, and I kept hearing that in a great Baptist church there would have been a song here, so I took his words and wrote it as a refrain. I'm going to have you sing it, hum it, okay? So I'll sing it once, then you hum it.
For the ones who are voiceless, speak the truth in the places of power. Who will speak so their voice will be heard? Tell me who will speak if you don't. Who will speak? Who will speak? Who will speak? So their voice will be heard. Who will speak if you don't? For the shunned and the outcast, who will speak for all people with AIDS? Who will speak so their voice will be heard? Oh, who will speak if we don't?
My friend John Bell says the greatest obstacle to congregational singing, or actually he says, the greatest obstacle to congregational singing are choir directors and organists. He says sometimes we get in the way from the very people we're trying to serve. At the beginning of the first day, Susan said, one assumption that we are going to make is that music is always at the service of the word and the community's prayer, and everything else is secondary. While not unimportant, is secondary. Did I say that one more time? Music is always at the service of the word and the community's prayer, and everything else, while not unimportant, is secondary. So what would be some of those things that are secondary?
How many flats is it?
How many flats? Ooh, zing. The style? Yeah. Instrumentation is secondary.
Language
is secondary. Musical form, whether it's call and response or hymn, is secondary to whether it serves the rite and the word. Microphones, any media. I remember one person told me the best singing she ever heard in a congregation was the Sunday she said, the organ is broke, you have to sing today. And everybody really sang because that was all there was to do. So for those of you who are all by yourself, I've been to some, interestingly enough, my Christmas at Holden here, I had spent years and years building up these incredible Christmases and never praying myself. And the Christmas we were at Holden, the only other person here at Christmas who played an instrument was a flute player. So we did guitar and flute and sang Christmas carols and did the liturgy. I prayed that so well for me in a way I'd never had before, by just clearing out and getting down to the real basics, the song and the people's voice. I'm going to talk about three models of music making. These are artificial constructs. They're stereotypes. Please don't take it personally. None of them are pejorative. I just think it's the way music gets made in our churches. The first one, no one church has one of these models. Everything is getting to be a blend. But I think this helps us sort of draw the battle lines. First one, classical, which means you would see a choir, oftentimes robed, maybe segregated by age. You might have a children's choir and adult choir. Music oftentimes, most often accompanied by organ. Most of the congregational song would be strophic hymnody. When the choir sings, it's almost always for the congregation to listen to. This is the, okay, that's enough of that model. You get to get a sense of that one. Second model is what I would call contemporary. Instrumentation might be guitar, piano, bass, drums, organ, synthesizer, saxophone, violins. The musicians typically sing along with the assembly on everything. The only difference is they've all got mics, and they can sing louder than the assembly. The groups are often segregated by age and style. The group I started at St. Bonaventure in 1973 is still together, except they're all now close to 50 years old. It was a high school group, and there many of them are still there. And then there's another 20-year-old folk group. So the form of the music, most of the music in the Catholic Church written since the Second Vatican Council is what I call pop music form, 16-bar verse, 16-bar refrain. Do you know what I'm talking about? Here I am, Lord, morning cry, all that. That's based on popular music on the radio. What both these models have in common is both of them originated in performance music making. If I go to hear the St. Olaf Choir or hear a great organ recital, it's music that I listen to. Although the organists are trained to accompany hymns, so that's not, you know, it's not strictly true, but the choirs in our Lutheran liberal arts colleges are typically trained to sing for people. The contemporary groups, which base their model on pop music, is also a group where someone sings for them. So you can see when we have a culture that's so thoroughly ingrained in listening to other people make music, it's hard to undermine that. It's hard for the congregation, but it's also hard for the musicians to rethink this and say, we're going to look this open. So I'm going to suggest a third model, which I would call a ministerial model. You've seen some of it here. Now, what we haven't done so far is a strophic hymn on the organ. And the organ here at Holden, we've decided we're not going to use the organ. It is not because we don't think that you should do music on the organ. We just don't think you should do music on that organ. And we think if we did music on that organ, you might think we thought that. So ministerial music doesn't say it's this style or that style. It says all styles are welcome provided they lift up the word and help the community in their prayer. The groups are open, they're intergenerational, they say young people become leaders and form as well. Instrumentation is based on the needs of the moment. So something is on organ, something else is on guitar or percussion, something else is on synthesizer. It's done in such a way that what is needed for the moment, and much of the music is done a cappella, simply because it really gives empowerment to the congregation. Okay, see those three models? Where I think I want living liturgy to go is to say, those who are classical need to embrace not only contemporary, but go beyond that and say, how can we say, going right back to this big T roots, where in Paul's time you sang songs, hymns, and inspired songs, and it doesn't say with synthesizer, guitar, or organ, or in this style, or in that style. It just says you sing. So the question is, and we'll get to the practical implications later when the question and answer period, but I want to talk about how we can think, rethink our models in terms of ministerial. So the musicians have to think busting open. The one piece I haven't really stressed yet is the collaboration. Ministry has to be collaborative between the various ministries or it doesn't happen at all. I'm going to talk about four people who I admire as presiders, who I've worked with. Two of them are Lutheran and two of them are Catholic. That's not the point. Their skills are the kind of skills that cross denominational lines. They are big T skills, I would say. So they predate denominational differences. One of them is a friend of mine, Ray East, and his gift is the gift to weave music and the arts and dance together with the spoken word as a presider. I've watched him move seamlessly from that. Too often, I think, in our society, we think, I'm an artist, so I don't have to know the word. I'm a musician, so I don't have to pay attention to the word. I'm a presider, so I don't have to know about music. I think this is less, Lutherans are less guilty of this, because I think Lutherans have had a sense that at least the pastor has to know about hymns of the day, I would hope. So they have a sense of music. But there hasn't been this strong sense of combining the artist and the healer and the leader of prayer and the keeper of stories into one person. The ministerial model for me of the presider is one who is the keeper of stories, the healer of the community, the leader of prayer for the community, and the artist in one. And Ray is that for me. Second one is Susan. And Susan's great gift to me is her incredible ability to totally give herself over to the prayer and let everything else drop away. And did Dan tell the story at this conference? This is how it's getting, you know. Was it this conference or the last conference where he talked about Susan actually fainting? Can I tell that story? Or you want to tell the story? I'll tell the story. Dan was at a liturgy where Susan was presiding, and she didn't seem to be her own self because she is so focused and able to really pray well with the people. And at this liturgy, she finished the sermon and then promptly fell over and passed out. And as they were dragging her out, and I'm telling the story the way I heard it, Daniel rushed up to her and Susan said, "You finished the liturgy, Dan." And that incredible ability to be so completely focused on the prayer of the people and giving herself over to that. Not becoming, I mentioned this morning, I realized I was not on track with this. Not becoming invisible, but not being Susan. Do you see the difference? I don't think we need to become invisible as a person there. The presider has to be a demonstrative center for the assembly, a strong center, but also an anonymous center to the degree that it is someone representing the community rather than representing themselves. And that's a great gift to me. Third one is a Hawaiian pastor named George DaCosta, and Mary's seen him as well. His great gift is to bring the culture of his people into the prayer. He's the one who put a koa bowl at the door and said, you put your offerings in the koa bowl, because that's what we did in the villages in ancient Hawaii, and the poorest of the poor would get from that bowl. So 10% of what comes out of that bowl, which is all the money that comes to the parish, goes right to programs for shelters and the homeless and poor. And I've watched him carry the book through the assembly, dancing. He's one of the few presiders I've seen who can actually dance and make it look good when he's holding a large book. So once again, the sense of bringing his own culture and the arts together. And finally, Dan, for me, has been just delightful. His ability to be so gently present, absolutely egoless in leading people in prayer. That's partly why I think if living liturgy falls apart, I don't think I can put together, I couldn't go out with any other people, because I don't think I could find other people as easily that are so good to pray with. I've asked Dan and Susan to talk a little bit about this, because my side of this is mostly as a musician, and so if they're willing to speak a little bit.
I want to share some words about the being the presider at the Eucharist. What I've found, it's in Lutheran circles, and this might be true in others, there's a certain misunderstanding, I think, that is so easy for us to adopt, and that if the presider and president, I assume, come from the same root, that it's a position that makes you look like you're not humble. So, or it's another place we might be afraid of looking what sometimes is called too Catholic. And that is for the presider to seem to be in the center of things. And in Man and Mercy, I call this the big deals. And we don't want to be a big deal in the church. So one way we do that, I think in the wrong way, is to try to be a presider without presiding. Do you get it? And one of them is a presider is the host of the meal, and therefore the presider should be seen so people are comfortable. Instead, so often we try to sit in a place where no one can see us so we don't look like we think we're a big deal. Then it's easy, too, for a presider to say, oh, my goodness, if I do the whole liturgy, it's going to look like I'm trying to take over. And so it's very easy for us to turn to the, if there's another pastor in the church, to say, well, you take it up and through the creed, and then I'll take the communion liturgy. And then, do you see what I mean? That makes us look more humble. And so what I'd like to just share is being a presider is a humble servant task. And the way I think to understand the role of presider is to think of where it comes from. And it comes from the ancient table fellowship. And we experience that in our society, I think. And I'll just say a little story of I am invited to a somewhat formal dinner. This isn't like, you know, come over for pancakes as much as it is a very special dinner at someone's house. And time it looks like you're too eager. No, never mind. That wasn't on my notes. But I ring the doorbell, and the door opens, and it's the host of the evening. And the host, in a strong and a gentle way, reaches out and greets me, and might first see me say, "Oh, so good to see you," and I'll respond, "Well, good to be here." Takes my hand or gives me a hug and then ushers me in so I know exactly where to go in the house. And the host then ushers me into the living room. And then there are some guests in there, other guests who came 3 minutes late. And the host introduces us, invites us to sit down. And then the host really makes it a comfortable place for us to tell our stories and to tell about our lives and to become acquainted with each other. And then when it is the right time, the host will say, and meantime the host maybe has run to the kitchen a few times, will announce that dinner is ready and will say, "Please come, please follow me." And then we go into the dining room. And then the host sits at the front of the table in that chair that has arms and nobody else has arms. And it is not that this person is a big deal. It is because this person is fulfilling an office. And that is the responsibility to make us comfortable. And so we enjoy the dinner and enjoy the fellowship. So then it is the host that invites us to pray and leads the prayer. And by sitting at the head of the table and not in the middle of the side, we can always see the host, and the host that is that does it well will make just simple signs of what's next. You know, will like point to a dish, you know, or invite someone to take a dish to pass. And part of the comfort of that meal is that the host knows how to do that and is also in a visible place. Then when it's time to go, the host will be very gentle, so I don't feel like he or she is trying to get rid of me. We have a friend, Bill Cole, who, when you're invited to his house for dinner, and he's joking, but when it's time for us to leave, he'll say, "Here's your hat, what's your hurry?" And then at the door, he'll say, "Well, come again when you can't stay so long." But he's kidding. But it'll be a gentle way, or maybe when there'll be a certain feeling in the room while it is time, and the guests will sense that. And then the host walks us to the door. And then at the door, there is the last conversation and a sense of blessing one another. And the host will tell us how wonderful it was to have us over. And then we will respond, "Well, we are so happy that we were able to be here and be together." And then the host will usher us out, maybe hug us goodbye. And then I walk to the car and I say, "Wasn't that a great evening?" Now, do you see the similarity? The presider is the host of the Eucharistic feast, and everything the host did in this dinner is our ministry when we are the presiding minister. And it is not a way of sitting there being a big deal, but it is there to make everyone in the congregation comfortable, to be present in a way that everyone can see me and therefore see what directions there might be with a hand or a word. And then finally, and this is the one people who know me know this is one of my problems, the host is so well prepared that no one has to have the anxiety as, "My goodness, what's going to happen next?" You know, like the first time I was presider here at, when I was campus pastor here in 1979, is that everyone was seated and the presider was running around up and down the pews because I couldn't find my hymnal. This isn't a real, do you follow what I mean? Well prepared, so there's a sense of confidence in this person. I'll leave it there, and then Susan is going to add on some of just the theology behind this hosting. So, Susan, I want to welcome you to the podium, and you may come up now and be right here.
Stay here with me.
Oh no, I think I'll be out to the kitchen for a minute. So.
Two things. I think the best book on the role of presider as minister in the assembly still is Robert Hovda's Strong, Loving, and Wise. That really is a classic, and maybe a new version of that needs to be written. But in this book, it's clear that the presider does need to be strong, trustworthy in the liturgy, so the assembly knows where to look, and loving in relationship with the assembly, not authoritarian, no power over, but the kind of loving that has some oomph underneath it, and wise, not simply knowledgeable about how to hold her hands or how to take the deep bow, but wise. And I take that to mean that this knowledge has gone down into us in such a way that in leading the people's prayer, our wisdom shapes the action day by day. I would make a plea to those in this room who are ordained ministers of word and sacrament to look again at what your parish called you to do when you were installed. To remember again that moment when you were led to the font by the people and handed some sign of your role to teach and catechize and baptize in this place, a shell, perhaps. And then weren't you led to the place of the Word and handled the Holy Scriptures, and they called you to abide in this Word, to be formed by this Word, to pray this Word, to know it coming to you both as law and as gospel. And then they called you to break open this Word in their midst. And then they brought you to the table. And by handing you cup and paten, they said, "We call you as one among us to preside at this table." If your people are saying, "What are you doing up there so much?" you say, "Well, you know, you called me to this office." One time at Holden, when I was serving as interim pastor, we had no musician. People usually think of this place as rich with musical skill and talent, but we had a winter with no musician. And it got so bad that at one Eucharist, at the time of the psalmody, I went to the piano and I played the antiphon, sang it, and they responded. I mean, I was the only game in town, and it was sad. That night, we had our general Sunday evening ritual, because we worship in the evening here, which was to go to our house and drink root beer and pop popcorn and talk about what happened. And my Magdalena said, "Mama, today you stepped outside your office." She said, "You are not called." The third thing she said, "If you need someone to lead the psalm, Mary Emily and I can do it." Now, if all of our people were formed so well to know what the work of the assembly is, and what the work of the presider is, I think presiders would be less afraid to claim that calling and to live into it with grace and strength and wisdom. So I encourage you to return to that and to claim it again. And even I'll just encourage you to claim again as the role of the presider, the saying of the prayer of the day. It does not belong to the people. And to claim again the great thanksgiving around the meal. And not to hand the words of institution to the congregation to say in unison while they hold their hands, as done in some places in our synod. That is your role, to proclaim the gospel at this point of the meal. So, and don't be afraid of that final blessing. That's not a communal moment. Your role there is to preside over the assembly, representing to them God's mission among them, which is forming a Eucharistic community in which the crucified and risen Christ is visible. So power to you, wisdom, strength. And if you wonder what you're supposed to do, just look at the LBW and see where the P is. So, because if you look carefully at what the presider does and what the lay assisting minister does, you'll begin to see what your function is through that whole liturgy.
I want to respond really briefly to what Susan said and then open it up. One of the things that I've experienced when I've done music and Susan presides that's been very good for me is I believe, and I talked about this briefly about collaborativeness, if the feast that we celebrate is truly an important feast, if we believe that it is truly something that is really critical and central to our faith, then all of our actions have to say that, and they have to give more care to that than even we would to the example Dan used. And for me, the great joy in to work with a presider who owns that and encourages me to work with him or her in that way is that the sum is more than the parts. When the musician and the presider together claim those things and say, I will hold you up, and you will hold me up, and we will together make this really rich and beautiful and strong. And if we have to cut something less big T to do that, we do that. I can't imagine to have the most important feast of my life and have this little brief prayer that doesn't carry the weight of the feast we're celebrating. Can I see if you have things you want to raise? Questions, issues, disagreements? This is the time of day where it's really... Yes, please, Mary.
I just want you to know that although we are of one mind, the five of us, we don't agree on everything. No, we aren't of one mind, actually, necessarily. I think on the important things we are of one mind, and that helps for our collaboration and how good we look up here working together. But we were just talking a little over on the side here about whether or not the prayer of the day needs to be said by the presider. So there are some conversations that are ongoing amongst our own group, and I just wanted to let you know that, because I'm sure that they are ongoing amongst all of you as well.
So am I to assume that you were talking while I was talking? Fair enough. Tom, do you want to add to this? Okay. Oh. Yeah. Well, the books I know tend to be more... They're not so much formal training books, and I don't know if there's a need for that. The ones I know are books like the wonderful book by Don Saliers, Worship Come to Its Senses. Who publishes that, Susan, do you know? Or Dan, do you know? Is it Paulist? I'm not sure who publishes it, but it's Don Saliers, Worship Come to Its Senses. I think it's a beautiful book on recapturing that wonderful awe. Do you recommend Gordon Lathrop's books? Holy Things and Holy People. I mean, I suppose that's like this. Everybody knows these books. I don't know. Holy Things and Holy People by Gordon Lathrop, both of which are in the bookstore. You want to say it, Susan?
Those who are called to teach the church have given us a wonderful gift in a book called Worship Inside Out. It's edited by Tom Schatower, and he has the leading essay in it. But following his essay, there is an essay by every teacher of liturgy in the ELCA. So Gordon Lathrop has an article. Pastor Hoffman has an article. Michael Onney has an article. Mons Teig has an article. And they look at the shape of the church in a world of mission, in an age of mission. And I commend that to you. The three seminaries that I think are forming preachers and presiders in a exemplary way would be Wartburg Seminary number one, that has really come to understand the heart of pastoral ministry, deeply grounded in confession, scripture, theology, Philadelphia, and Trinity. In the larger seminary, what happens too often is I think we end up with departments, a liturgy department and then a preaching department, and there is very little conversation or cross-fertilization, and so preachers are taught to preach as if that's the only thing that happens, and liturgists, there's just no conversation there about how the whole thing is part of the liturgy. So you might look at those teachers and see if there are any classes online that are offered by them.
Do we have to stop right now? Do we have time for another question or two? I don't know. Should we stop? Any other burning questions? Or your heart's burning? Or yes. I didn't say the gospel. I mean, I said that anyone can read scripture. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I can give you an example. One Sunday, a woman got up and said, I'm reading from a Bible, and Paul went off from there to these are really hard words. And she got to the end and she looked up and said, thank you. And the whole congregation went, you're welcome. I mean, I'm not exaggerating. That was the reading. Yeah. No, Dan, that wasn't what you were asking.
The point is that not that everybody can read, but that people are not trained who are reading.
Yeah, and I think faith is not passed on from page to page. Faith is passed on from heart to heart. And I think, I don't think we don't want to get into a heavy argument about things like the opening prayer, but I do think there is a rhythm in prayer of acclamation and proclamation that you respect that says it's this back and forth stuff, if it's done well, that creates that energy. And if the word is proclaimed badly, if the person proclaiming it doesn't have it in their heart, why should the congregation take it home in theirs? So you have to speak at least as well as somebody who would get up to tell you the weather. I would hope that the readers would be trained in that. And there is going to be a lecture training workshop, right? Are you doing that, Mary? Yeah.
This is in response to the comment about departmentalizing things. In a lot of churches I've been in, the pastor meets with the worship committee, but nobody that does worship is in that worship committee. Like the choir director, mm-hmm. or if they're not there.
We're going to have a couple workshops on worship planning, and I think we're going to cover that, aren't we? I mean, I think you're raising a point that really needs to be addressed. I don't want to get into it too depth now because we're going to actually have workshops that are going to raise that very point and how important that is. But you are raising a very important point about who should be involved, integral in that kind of process. Yeah.
Sandy, I agree, but this is the misconception that what the presider doing is somehow the holy act. The presider isn't doing the holy act. The presider is leading the whole assembly in its holy act of praise of God. And the presider is making space for God's holy act, which is... God's mission in the world is here, making space for us to encounter God's holy act among us. So if what a presider is doing, how he or she is doing his or her role, makes it look as if I've got the secret words or the magic words and the magic acts, and you are just spectators, then there's something wrong with the presidential role. But if, as Dan says, this role of host becomes, as it always does for Jesus, the role of servant, what the presider will communicate is that her role is servant to God's mission among us and our common prayer and praise. So this demarcation, it isn't, I think, in our wanting to be inclusive, we fall into a misconception that everybody's role needs to be the same or everybody needs to be able to do everybody's role. In my household, there are two parents and two children. And there are points at which we don't confuse those roles because that would be to the detriment of the children. I'm not comparing the presider and the people to the parent and children. But I'm saying it isn't a hierarchy of roles. It's different offices. It's different callings among us, different gifts among us. Some are called to be apostles, some prophets, some teachers. So what I'm saying about the presider is Lutheran theology says that a minister is called by an assembly, and you have called the ordained ministers to Holy Trinity to serve you in this way. That's their call among you. And you've got all kinds of other calls, vocations in the world where you are presiding, where perhaps you're the charge nurse presiding over the ward, or perhaps you're the LPN washing the feet in the nursing home, presiding over that act. We all have presidential moments, but at the Eucharist, the one who presides is the one the people have asked and called to do that work. And then ask the Holy Spirit to confer the power to do that work. Lutheran anthropology, the way we understand the human being, is very informative here. We don't say that Lutherans are growing more and more toward holiness. Other traditions say that, growing in grace toward holiness. We say from the beginning to the end, we are simul justus et peccator. We are both justified by God and broken and sinful. So every one of these roles has the capacity to be misused by the one who has the role. And I think that does happen.
I just think it's a very great privilege. And in some circumstances, I think that we should let it happen because it can be a gift to everyone.
What's the antecedent to that pronoun? Let it, what happen? Interesting. And I'll think about that.
I wish we could keep talking. Yeah. It's hard to have a deep question come at the time of the bell. Can we sing a couple verses? Can we sing a couple verses?
Quickly.
We'll sing two really fast verses, 476 in the Gather Hymnal.
476.
Let's do the first, second, and last verse. In peace.
As you go, just keep in mind there's a session now over in Koinonia and a session at 6:15, two breakout sessions. And then at 6:45, anyone wants to sing tonight, come at 6:45 here. We're especially in need of altos, sopranos, basses, and tenors.